And if you would like to take your Bibles out and turn to Revelation chapter 2, Rachel's going to come and read for us. Revelation is the last book of the Bible, so just flip to the end, and we're in chapter 2, and from verse 12 to 17.
To the church in Pergamum. To the angel of the church in Pergamum write, "These are the words of him who has the sharp, double-edged sword. I know where you live, where Satan has his throne, yet you remain true to my name. You did not renounce your faith in me, not even in the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was put to death in your city where Satan lives. Nevertheless, I have a few things against you. There are some among you who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to entice the Israelites to sin so that they ate food sacrificed to idols and committed sexual immorality. Likewise, you also have those who hold to the teaching of the Nicolaitans. Repent, therefore. Otherwise, I will soon come to you and will fight against them with the sword of my mouth. Whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who is victorious, I will give some of the hidden manna. I will also give that person a white stone with a new name written on it, known only to the one who receives it."
Thank you very much. And let me add my welcome. My name's Graham. I'm one of the leaders here at Grace Church, if you don't know me. And we're working through this series to the letters to the churches in Revelation. Do have that open in front of you. I presume you know the story of the Trojan horse. The Greeks were supposedly trying to defeat the city of Troy. And they began with a kind of full-on assault. You know, attack the walls, batter the gates, and so on. But they couldn't get in. And so they pretended to retreat, but left a giant wooden horse filled, hiding elite fighters inside. And so they came out of the city and they dragged the horse inside, and that night the fighters come out and they attack the city from the inside, as it were. See, there are different tactics in a war. There is front-on assault, where, as it were, you can see it coming. Everyone can see what is happening, and there is subterfuge, deception. Rather than battering down the front door, you sneak around the back and come in the side window. And the same is true in the battle for the Christian faith. Satan is the great enemy of believers, a spiritual force at work trying to undermine and destroy the faith of believers. He appears in these letters. We've seen him mentioned already. But he works in different ways. Frontal assault sometimes. Deception. Side window. And in this letter that Jesus is writing to the church in Pergamon, we're going to see both of those. And we're going to see that the church has done well in facing one sort of attack, not so well in the other. Let me just remind you, if you're new to us, Jesus is writing to seven churches. Let's have a map up. I don't think we've done a map yet. John, who is writing the letter, is on the island of Patmos, and he's writing to these seven churches. We've looked at the letter to Ephesus and Smyrna, and today we're going on to Pergamon. It goes round in that kind of circle. In each letter, Jesus commends them for what they're doing well. "I know this about you. Well done. Keep going." Where they're staying loyal to him. And he rebukes them for where they are letting go or giving in. Now, we've said as you've studied this, one of the things you have to remember is, of course, we are not these churches. Jesus is writing to Ephesus or Smyrna or Pergamon in this case. And we are not necessarily worthy of their commendation that they receive. Well done. And we're not necessarily deserving of the rebuke. It depends. It depends how we match up. And so we have to both look at what Jesus says to them and then ask, what is he saying to us? Well, let's do that. The first thing I think Jesus is saying from here is an encouragement to stand firm. There's our first heading. Stand firm. See verse 12. To the angel of the church in Pergamon write, these are the words of him who has the sharp double-edged sword. I know where you live, where Satan has his throne. If you were a Christian in first century Turkey, you wouldn't be looking for a job move to the city of Pergamon, because it was notorious for how difficult it would be there. Jesus says it is where Satan has his throne. It's like this is Satan's camp. This is where Satan rules. And he's probably referring to a couple of things that we know about the city of Pergamon. First of all, in the Roman Empire, there was official worship of the Roman ruler Caesar. Emperor worship, it was called. There was a ceremony where all citizens had to stand in front of an official and throw incense into a fire and declare, Caesar is Lord. Everyone had to do it. But Christians couldn't, wouldn't declare Caesar was Lord like that. Jesus is Lord. Now, Stu gave an example last week of exactly that ceremony with a guy called Polycarp. Now, this is what resulted in Christians being thrown to the lions or burnt alive or killed in some other way. So that was happening across the empire, but Pergamon had the first temple ever built in honor of Caesar. Here's what's left of it. Not much there now. But this was like the headquarters of this emperor worship in the area. Secondly, in Pergamon, it was something of a center for worship of other gods. There were a number of pagan gods of the day. There are at least four really significant ones in Pergamon. Like one of them was Athena. Here she is and what's left of her temple in Pergamon. And in that culture, everyone was expected to join in worship of these gods. There were various feasts, trade guilds and things, and you're supposed to join in. That puts Christians under huge pressure. That is why Jesus says, I know where you live, where Satan has his throne. Satan is a spiritual power opposed to God, but he works through all kinds of means. He can work through false religions, for example. He can work through oppressive governments. So I expect Jesus might say to our brothers and sisters around the world, I know where you live. I know the government of North Korea. I know the danger from some Muslim factions in Pakistan. Now, we don't face that kind of pressure in this country, although some living here could, a Muslim background believer could face that in this country. But some of us might work somewhere where it's particularly hard to be a Christian and stand for him, or be in a family where it's particularly difficult. And Jesus would say, I know where you live. But what does he go on to? He doesn't then say, I know where you live, and so kick Satan off his throne. Claim the victory, because I'm more powerful, although Jesus is. He doesn't say that. Instead, he commends them for loyalty under pressure. I know where you live, verse 13, yet you remain true to my name. Literally, you hold to my name. You're kind of clinging on to my name. You won't let it go. And so you did not renounce your faith in me, not even in the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was put to death in your city where Satan lives. Even when things got really tough, when your friend had been killed. And just imagine that. Someone here at Grace, killed for their faith, executed by an oppressive government or a mob, and you're thinking, well, it could have been me. And we might be next. You did not renounce your faith in me, not even when this was happening. I was talking to Emmanuel, who's joined us here, sitting at the front, who's from northern Nigeria. We were talking last week. He was telling me they're from an area where Boko Haram operate. And we talked about Christians being executed last week, and he was telling me of a pastor's wife who was beheaded last year. Well, I'm a pastor and my wife's sitting there. You did not renounce your faith in me, not even in the days of Antipas. You stood firm under pressure. Last week, with Smyrna, Jesus was basically stealing them for opposition to come. Don't be afraid of what you're about to suffer. The devil's going to do this to you. Hold on in it. This week, he's kind of going, well done for having come through it. You stood firm, and I know it's hard. And I take it that that is an ongoing encouragement. Whatever does come, stand firm. Stick with me. Don't renounce your faith. And that is what he would say to our brothers and sisters around the world, facing this kind of full frontal assault, the deny Jesus, the full-on pressure. That's what he'd say to us if we're pressured. Work, family, maybe if our culture changes in this country, maybe we will face more of that. He would say, stand firm. So, they're doing well. They're doing very well in withstanding the full frontal assault. But there is something else going on as well. Secondly, beware deception. Verse 14. Nevertheless, I have a few things against you. There are some among you who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to entice the Israelites to sin so that they ate food sacrificed to idols and committed sexual immorality. Okay, what's that about? Here's the background. This is referring to an event in the Old Testament, first part of the Bible, where a king called Balak wanted to fight the Israelites, but he thought they were blessed by God, so I want to try and put a curse on them to sort of undermine them. So I call in a prophet called Balaam, and I say, I'll pay you to curse them for me. And Balaam kind of goes, oh, okay, but Balaam comes to try and do it, and God won't let him. As soon as he opens his mouth, only blessing comes out. And so it doesn't work, the tactic doesn't work. And so having tried, as it were, the blunt instrument of cursing them, Balaam suggests a different approach. He suggests, I can't curse them, try this instead, get some of your women to sidle up to some of their men and invite them over for a meal. Except it's not an ordinary meal. It's a meal held in honor and worship of their pagan gods. It's a very religious meal. And so, verse 14, Balaam taught Balak to entice the Israelites to sin so that they ate food sacrificed to idols and committed sexual immorality. The sexual immorality there could have two meanings. It could mean actual sex, physical sex outside marriage. And back with Balak, that was going on. But it can also mean kind of spiritual adultery, kind of turning your back on Jesus and God as your sort of true husband, as it were, turning from faithfulness. And in Revelation, That's usually its main meaning. We'll see it again next week. See, this was Balaam's Trojan horse. Side door, deceptive. Get people to turn away from God. You see the word entice there. Enticed them to sin so that they, not forcing them, not holding their head down and threatening them with someone with a sword hanging over, but beckoning. Come on. And Jesus says, you have people among you who hold to this teaching. Verse 15, likewise, you also have those who hold to the teaching of the Nicolaitans. The Nicolaitans, it seems, are a group who are teaching something very similar. It's like they're the modern-day version of what Balaam and Balak were doing. And we don't know exactly what they were saying. We don't know, I haven't had any more information about them. But I think we can have a pretty good guess. Because there were numerous feasts going on in these different temples, public festivals, the birthday of Caesar, meals as part of a trade guild and so on, held in local temples, held in honor of that god, with food being offered in worship, and Christians are being invited on. Great pressure to attend. If you know, you're a Christian business person, in Pergamon, you deal in cloth, for example, or come to the annual trade guild for the cloth dealers. It's at the Temple of Athena. And not going, well, that might put you out of business. But there's this group who says it's okay to go. They're called the Nicolaitans. They say it's all right. They say God understands. God doesn't want you to go out of business. And after all, it's only a cultural thing. You don't really mean it. Now, we don't know their actual argument. But whatever they were doing and saying, they were leading people to disloyalty to God by taking part in those sorts of things. Enticing to sin rather than pressuring to disloyalty. And so Jesus says, beware deception. When there are people on the inside, in your camp, saying things that are leading people to disown me and be disloyal to me, but it's all rather subtle. Well, today, for example, in the Muslim world, some people have suggested that because of the persecution that would come otherwise, Muslims who come to faith should still take part in Islamic festivals, including having to say, there's no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. And people could say, well, it's just a formality. Lots of people say it who don't really believe it. But surely a Christian could never say those words. I was involved once back in Leicester with a couple who were considering getting married in a Muslim country. One of them was from this country. And the marriage ceremony itself would involve saying, no God but Allah. And some people were saying to them, it's okay. It's like, it's a nothing. It's just everyone says it. Don't worry about it. Well, Caesar is Lord. Everyone says it. Don't worry about it. I think that is this sort of voice. It's a voice that is arguing for a form of compromise and saying it's okay. Now, what about us here? I can't think of an official occasion where we'd be called to declare such things. But there are voices within the Christian world that would say it's okay to change our position on various things, particularly things where we're pressured from our culture. You know, the uniqueness of Christ, that other religions won't get you anywhere. Our sexual ethics, gender, homosexuality, voices that will say it's okay to get divorced when there's no substantive reason to do so, or okay to marry a non-Christian, or whatever. Very often saying a kind of, well, God understands, and God doesn't want you to be lonely or to suffer or whatever. And it can often be presented as the loving thing to say or to do. Don't want to draw hard lines and say you can't do that, shouldn't do that. Now, of course, in any of these instances, we have to be clear, what is it Jesus teaches? Talk that through, argue that through. The point is, when we're clear what he teaches, do we stick to it even when actually we're tempted not to? Even when there are voices saying it's okay not to? Even when they're saying this is the loving thing? Well, we should always be loving, but we never use love as a reason to compromise. In fact, it's not loving to do so. It's actually harmful to people to say such things. And look, some areas are quite black and white. You know, you do this or you don't do that. You declare Caesar is Lord. You declare there's no God but Muhammad. You say homosexual activity is okay, or it's okay to get divorced or something. Other areas, well, it's not as simple. It's not a simple yes or no. But there are lots of other forms of compromise. You know, we could justify greed, selfishness, living for our own comfort, lack of generosity, lack of hospitality, care. You know, we could just water down discipleship. Much harder to pinpoint because it's not doing A or B, it's made up of lots and lots of small things. My point is simply that the same dynamic can be there. And this is the Trojan horse, the side door. Creep into the city and bring it down from the inside. And Jesus says, you have people among you who hold this. So verse 16, repent therefore. Otherwise, I will soon come to you and fight against them with the sword of my mouth. See, there was the very understandable fear of what would happen if they didn't take part in some of these things. Social exclusion, financial hardship, at worst, the sword of Rome was held over them. And Jesus introduces himself at the start in verse 12 as the words of the one who has the double-edged sword. And he comes back to it here. His words then have power. And here I think he is thinking of the power of judgment. I will fight against them with the sword of my mouth. I will speak words of judgment on them. In other words, I'm the one you need to be most worried about here. Loyalty to me is the most important thing, whatever the threats and whatever the temptations. And loyalty to Jesus, bewaring deception and standing firm, is always worth it. Verse 17, whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who is victorious, I will give some of the hidden manna. I will also give that person a white stone with a new name written on it, known only to the one who receives it. Each letter finishes with this call to hear what the Spirit is saying and a promise for those who are victorious. The being victorious here is staying loyal. You know, Antipas was victorious. Didn't look like it. He was. He held on to Jesus. And that promise always pictures final salvation in some way, but it does so in a way that is particularly suitable for this group. So what is it here? It is the hidden manna, which I think refers to the feast in heaven, the new creation, the wedding banquet between Christ and his people. The white stone we are less sure of, but probably draws on the practice of white stones being used as a kind of invitation to a feast, a kind of entry ticket. And the new name written on it, well, the new name is in Revelation, is always used of Jesus himself. And so it points to Jesus personally inviting, revealing himself to that person, saying, I want you at my feast. And so what is being pictured is, instead of compromising and joining in the feasts of the day, stay loyal to Jesus and you'll eat with him. You're tempted to join in these here and now. Hold on. You'll be at the best feast you could ever dream of. And you won't regret on that day what you've given up or what you've suffered, because loyalty to Jesus will always be worth it. The 16th century was the last time in this country that people were officially executed for their faith, as in by the government, rather than by a mob or something. And where Nicholas Ridley was going to be burnt at the stake for his faith, the night before he said, though my breakfast will be somewhat sharp, my supper will be all the more pleasant and sweet. Well, it's quaint phrasing, but he looked at the suffering and he looked through the suffering and said, it would be worth it, I stay loyal. These promises that come at the end of these letters are life-changing, perspective-changing. If we really believe there is life to come, it changes how we live now. This is not what we live for. We can sit loose to this world, and we can even suffer in this world for Christ because of what is coming. Stay loyal to Jesus. Be victorious. Stand firm in the face of pressure. The front-on attack that pushes you, resist. The deceptive teaching that entices you, stay loyal to Jesus. Now, as we looking through these letters and thinking, what does Jesus say to them, and then what's he saying to us? I thought we'd try something a little bit new. And so I've asked a couple of people if they would contribute. I've asked them to reflect on the passage, and I've told them roughly what I was saying. And I've asked them for what they're struck by and what they feel God might be saying to us. So if Jay Rigby and Mirek could join me at the front, they're going to share briefly some of their reflections. Jo.
Okay. Often when I hear passages like this about persecution, I end up feeling bad because I'm not sure I've ever been persecuted for my faith. But what strikes me from the passage now is that there's a whole spectrum of attacks from the devil on Christians, a huge range and diversity of circumstances in which we're called to stay faithful to Jesus. It's all the way from physical persecution in other countries at the moment, to social pressure to stay silent in this country's culture, to pressure to compromise our biblical values that we hold to in church. The passage shows us that our small moments of faithfulness matter, as well as the big moments. It might be choosing to speak up about Jesus to a friend when it would be easier to stay silent. It might be as simple as talking about church when someone asks us how our weekend was. Or it might be speaking up in a discussion about different religions or sexuality or gender issues, and respectfully and humbly giving our views, even if we know that some will take offence or ridicule us or call us intolerant. I was also struck by how the church in Pergamum wanted to fit in with the culture surrounding them, hence their compromises to the faith. And we can face that too, a sort of uncomfortable feeling that we don't quite fit in, and how much easier it would be if we just blended into our surrounding culture and didn't have to stand out. But this passage reminds us that it's good that we don't fit in. We're called to be different, we're following a different God, and that not fitting in is worth it because there'll be something better for us in heaven. That going along with culture will not bring us the security or reward that we look for. That's a deception. Our reward in heaven will outweigh anything experienced here.
Thank you very much.
When I read the passage, and every single time, I think what's always struck me that in Pergamum is the throne of the evil one, and I'm thinking if evil one is spiritual being, and he's not almighty, so he cannot be everywhere, so he can send like different beings on behalf of him, but seems to be that in Pergamon that's where he's ruling from, and that behind all those powers could be Caesar, could be different worship, is some force. And what came to my mind is Ephesians 6:10-12, and that's probably that they knew it, because the letter to Ephesians was written way before the revelation. So maybe they had even this letter. Finally, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Put on full armor of God so that you can take stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of his dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. So that, I think, give us more insight. Well, sometimes something what seems to be like can be physical attack or something is not just that. It's much more deeper, and we should be aware of that. And I think another passage came to my mind is from James, where when he encouraged us, submit yourself then to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. And I think we should be, as Graham said, we should stay loyal to Jesus, but at the same time, it's like to all his teaching. If he said something, it's very important, like he's all-knowing, he is our Lord. And if he said something is for our goodness, it's like to stick to his teaching, and probably that will be, that doesn't mean, in one way, it will be easier, but it doesn't mean that will remove all the suffering or persecution. And I think the example from Nigeria is this young sister, Lea Sharibu, who was kidnapped with other girls from Chibok in 2018. It was 100 girls, and she's the only one who stay with Boko Haram because she didn't denounce Jesus. All the girls, one girl died, and then all others within a month, they were recovered to the families, but she stayed with Boko Haram because she didn't want deny Jesus. And that's kind of very hard, but that's probably when she stick to the teaching. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, both of you, for those thoughts, just filling out and beginning to apply more some of what we're thinking about. We'll have a chance to do that more in our small groups this week, to reflect together on what God's saying to us and calling us to. Let's have a moment's quiet now for us to reflect what is Jesus's message to us, and then I'll lead us in prayer.